Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on debt when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments and licenses and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights. And permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by government agencies like OSHA or the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. Let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call right now and order one. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on the email and then request our free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about debt. Now's time to start talking about, well, okay, now we have been talking about debt. How do you get out of debt? What do you do to eliminate this debt? The traditional modality here in America is called bankruptcy. Now, bankruptcy has always had a stigma attached to it. Oh, you've been through bankruptcy. Well, it doesn't have nearly the stigma today that it has had in the past. But in times past, you know, back in the Middle Ages, we used to have a thing called peonage and debtor's prison. So if you couldn't pay your debts, we'd throw you into prison. That was the penalty that you paid. It was a crime akin to theft. You know, if you went out and you stole somebody's cow, we would call you a thief. And then when we caught you, we would punish you by putting you in the dungeon, or we'd put you in jail because you're a thief. Now, a person who steals through credit is just as much a thief, except that it's treated a little different. We see that when you go into the Best Buy store and you buy your big screen TV and you take it home and you don't make the payments, and of course they take the TV back and they sell it to somebody else, or they do something, then they nail you for a deficiency charge on it. We here in our society, we view that as a different kind of theft. Yeah, it's true, you agreed to pay and you didn't pay, and for whatever reason, and so we are much more lenient. And it goes back into biblical times, because we used to have a thing called the year of release, where you have to release every debtor's debt once every 7 years. And so we still follow that. You know, your bankruptcy is good for about 6 years, and then in the seventh year, you know, your credit comes back again. We do that with the military. You know, when you join for 6 years, and then in the seventh year, you're free because you're a Hebrew unbought. So we still follow some of these traditions from the Bible. to, you know, an Anglo-Saxon administration right now to this day. Now, there's some various and sundry ways for you to absolve this debt, but what I was pointing out is that they're going back now because there are some debts you cannot absolve, such as your taxes. You can't bankrupt out of your taxes or your school or your student loans, so you can't bankrupt out of those. Now, you can't bankrupt out of your credit cards, your credit card debt. So we're headed back toward feudalism and peonage and debtor's prison. That's where we're headed. Now, I don't know what the future holds. I'm not a prophet. I'm not here to say, well, you know, Congress, you know, in the next 10 years is going to introduce debtor's prison again. I don't know that. Justice William O. Douglas made an observation in a case called Sniadec versus Family Finance Corporation. He said, today's debtor proceedings are as bad as or worse than the debtor's dungeon of the Middle Ages. Now, he was a chief, not the chief, but he was an associate justice of the United States Supreme Court, William O. Douglas. Case was called Sniadec versus Family Finance. And that was his observation. He said he thought that the proceedings that we're putting people through today are as bad as or worse than the debtor's prison. Well, I don't know that that's true or that's false. That's his opinion. And you can, you know, form your own opinion over here. But now it's worse than when Douglas was sitting on the bench. Well, he made that observation back in the 60s. Today, you know, you can't bankrupt out of certain debts. They just stick with you forever. I've got one of those. I've got an IRS debt that I took on back in 1981, I believe it was. And when I die, I'm still going to have that debt. As my caseworkers, Mary Trudeau, said, that was a just debt that you owe to the United States government. And I said, well, just like Joe Lewis, you know, when he checked out, he owed the government $3.5 million, and I'm probably going to owe the government about $3.5 million also. Well, I hope so, because I'd rather owe it to them than beat them out of it. Now, I don't deny it's a just debt, and I owe it. I don't deny that. But I don't have the money to pay it, and I have avoided having the money to pay it. I have avoided income. You know, Americans today want more and more income so that they can spend more and more income on more and more consumerism. And I took a look in the Bible, and I found something a little bit different there. Let me describe it. It's called just weights and balances. Here in America, we used to practice just weights and balances, thou shalt not steal, which was extrapolated from the Ten Commandments and placed into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, where it says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. A part and parcel of this consumerism and the great ripoff of the consumer, of the average citizen, began with the Roosevelt administration. In fact, I showed you in the last program, started a little earlier, that with the Hoover administration, rampant consumerism. And the process was exacerbated by the fiat currency of the day. That is, Roosevelt enacted a provision through Congress called House Joint Resolution 192, and they took our gold away from us. So we couldn't pay our debts, and they gave us this paper money. Then the paper money evolved into checks, and the checks evolved into credit cards, and then the credit cards, checks, and paper money evolved into fiat currency, and that's where you're at today. Credit, debt, bondage, and servitude. Now, there's a little better way called private business, called just weights and balances, called gold and silver coin. I want to throw that one out here at the beginning here so that we can get our feet on the ground. If you want to leave the fiat currency system behind, and if you want to go back to practicing just weights and balances out of the Mosaic Law, out of the Ten Commandments, and if you'd like to get out of debt and own your house free and clear, and you know, when you've got some money, you spend it, and when you don't have it, you don't spend it. And then you don't have any monthly bills. Now, for instance, the first of the month is a real breeze for me because we don't have any bills. So I don't make out any checks, you know, to pay the bills. There's three or four obligations that come in, you know, like property taxes. You know, you gotta pay that. The phone bill comes in, you know. And the power bill, you know, the electric company, they want to get paid and so on. So there are three or four of these normal bills, but you know, electricity is not a necessity, it's a luxury. And the Amish people demonstrate that. Automobiles are luxuries, not necessities. The Amish, again, you know, don't have any automobiles, don't have any electricity to get by quite nicely. They're living their lives, and they're just doing fine, last time I checked. Now, of course, a lot of Americans would say, well, who wants to live like that? Well, people that want to be out of debt and don't want to have gastric indigestion at the first of the month, don't want to go through bankruptcy, juvenile delinquency, and divorce. You know, people, you know, that want to live their lives with a lot less stress, you know, to live like the Amish people do. So I've taken a look at the Amish people, and there's some things about their lifestyle I didn't care too much for. I kind of like electricity, quite frankly. And I kind of like automobiles. There's certain things that I kind of like, and I'm not Amish, but there's some things there that the Amish do. And I like their cash lifestyle, and I like their debt-free lifestyle, and I like their health and their farm lifestyle. And so I've adopted some of that. So, kind of like old King Solomon, I took a look at some of the things that some other people do, which is what I wanted to make tonight's report, the five benefits of working at home. I work at home. In fact, I just measured it off. I'm 54 steps from work, from my kitchen table, you know. If I'm in my bedroom, you know, I'm 68 steps, I believe it is, and 55 from the kitchen table. That's my commute to work. And so I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I take my shower and then I commute to the kitchen table and sit down, have a cup of coffee or something, and then I commute from the kitchen table down to my office where I'm now hard at work doing my thing. And there's some benefits that you receive for working at home. Now, most Americans want a job. They learned that from George Bush in the election cycle. What Americans want is jobs, jobs, jobs. Okay, if you want to be a credit debt surf, and you want to have debt, and you want a job and a paycheck, and you want to pay a third of everything you create and produce to the government in the form of income tax and Social Security, a job is just what you're looking for, partner. Get right in there and get after it. Now, I don't want to give a third of what I create and produce away to the government. I didn't like that idea. I don't like Social Security, and I don't want to participate in it. I think it's the mark of the beast. If you want Social Security, it's the third rail of politics. Most Americans desire it, want it, love it, participate in it. If you want to, get after it. I don't want it. And the same thing with the income tax. You know, a lot of people, they just see the income tax as the patriotic thing to do, and I just can't wait to pay my income tax. If you want it, get after it. I don't want it. How about Federal Reserve notes and credit cards? No, sir. I don't want any Federal Reserve notes, and I don't want any credit cards. And it goes on like that. And so here's five benefits that you get for working at home. And as we progress along, I'm going to show you some benefits that you get for obeying God and keeping His commandments. And I think it's a better program. Solomon came to that conclusion. He burned the candle at both ends, had 1,000 wives, and he got to the bottom line. He said, yeah, maybe the Ten Commandments aren't as bad as I thought they were. I've been a practicing communist most of my life, and I went out and practiced the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. It didn't work when I tried it. Now, partner, maybe you're smarter than I am, and you can make communism work for you, but I tested it. It didn't work for me. So I went back to the Ten Commandments. Now, we in America started with the Ten Commandments. And then we elected a guy named Franklin Roosevelt, and he said the Ten Commandments are a bunch of nonsense and that you need to practice an economy. You want to practice jobs, jobs, jobs. You need to get in here and practice insurance like Social Security. So he introduced... Franklin Roosevelt introduced the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our political and economic system. And we've been practicing it since 1933. And I tried real hard, but I couldn't make it work for me. And so I gave it up and went back to the Ten Commandments. Now, if you're disillusioned with communism and you've figured out that it doesn't work very well, let me suggest the Ten Commandments. Because the Ten Commandments applied from 1787 to 1950 produced the wealthiest, most powerful nation on planet Earth. The richest, most powerful nation of people, politically, economically, and militarily, the world has ever seen. Outdid the Roman Empire. And starting about 1950, it's been unraveling and disintegrating. Started a little before that, but, you know, it really started to take effect around 1950. And we've been on the slippery slope ever since. And so if you're taking a look at where we're at here in America today, you know, with the war in Afghanistan and Iran, or Iraq, and one coming up with Iran and so on, and you're getting kind of disillusioned, you know, with all the debt that you've got and the payments that you're making and so on, maybe you're ripe for a meaningful change. Now, other people have been making these meaningful changes. And not just right-wing reactionary lunatic fringe kooks like little Georgie Gordon here. I mean, there's normal run-of-the-mill people out there that are doing the same thing. And so, taking a look here at a couple of articles from the internet, listen to this. Who knew that a beer out here, and I'm citing this now from MSN Money, Financial Sanity down a country road. And here's a lady over here. Her name is, see if I can read her name here, M.P. Dunleavy. I think she's an author. I think she's a writer. And this comes from MSN Money, Financial Sanity Down a Country Road. And you can get this as http://articles.moneycentral.msn.com. Kind of a long one here. It's http://. Okay, you ready? articles.moneycentral.msn.com. Now, just a three-page article. Let me just run through it quickly here with you. Listen to this. She starts off, says, last fall, many readers of this column were skeptical when I announced that my husband and I had decided to take some dramatic steps in the name of financial and emotional sanity. He would quit his job and take care of our son. We would shift our lives from the city to rural upstate New York. I would bite my nails for a living. And we would come out financially ahead in the end. And I didn't want to admit this at the time, but I felt less confident than I sounded. One part of me did the math and was sure that we would end up saving a nice chunk of money by becoming country mice. The other part of me developed severe abdominal pains, true, and I ended up having a CT scan less than a week after we moved. The diagnosis, severe financialitis. Fortunately, I recovered, because it seems that making the big downshift is having a positive financial impact after all. I have to admit, though, that it's not happening in the ways that we expected. I assumed that giving up our apartment in the city and moving to our much cheaper house in the country would have the biggest impact on our budget. As it turns out, it's more the lifestyle change that has altered our spending habits. New York City dwellers like to quip that everything has a $20 sidewalk tax to live there in New York City because it feels like you spend $20 the second you step out your front door. As my husband and I discovered, it's not a joke. Even though we live in a small town and can walk to a couple of shops and restaurants, the ratio of commercial outlets to disposable income has plunged. And the result is a dramatic drop in impulse buying of all sorts, from bagels to books to let's meet for lunch and don't I need that sweater. That's very significant, because according to a 2006 telephone survey of 2,000 adults by the Pew Research Center, it's not necessarily the big ticket items that sink your budget. It's the steady onslaught of little ones. A quarter of the respondents said that food and dining out accounted for their biggest spending splurges, followed by entertainment and recreation, 17%. And shopping and personal items like clothes, 15%. Now, it's not just your imagination. There is a squeeze on the middle class. MSN Money's Liz Pulliam Weston explains how it's possible for anyone to get into the middle class and stay there. Readers on the message board who saw this survey agreed. One woman shocked her husband by showing him a bank statement, documenting the fact that in 1 month he spent $400 on all of the items in the $10 range, many of which he purchased at overpriced convenience stores in gas stations. So there's a twist on income expectations. Another unexpected financial twist, although we had expected to lose about $1,500 a month when my husband quit his job to become a stay-at-home dad. We hoped to find part-time work, or we hoped rather that he would find part-time work, and thus we'd keep some of his income. Again, we were thinking like city folks who take for granted an abundance of part-time and freelance work opportunities in the city. Such things tend to be very scarce out here in the dairy country in the dead of winter. Instead, with my husband working full-time on the domestic front, not only taking care of our son but running the house and being Mr. Fix-It, I've been able to work more, bumping my monthly income to about $6,000 a month gross. Okay, so this lady is kind of upscale, $6,000 a month. I've also committed to a few extra freelance projects that will add some $12,000 to our income as the year progresses. But because that money will not arrive for a while, and freelance projects have a nasty tendency to vanish the moment you rely upon them, I'm only counting on my steadiest income. So, the real purpose in moving out of the spendosphere of the city life isn't just that you spend less out here in the country. It's because things actually cost less out here in the rural areas. A typical dinner, or diner rather, the typical diner breakfast in the city will set you back $20 for two people. Here we pay about $11. Going out for drinks in the city easily starts at $20. Now, on the rare occasion that we hit the town watering hole, beers start at $1.50. No, I didn't make that up. A beer is $1.50. We were equally stunned, in a good way, by the cost of childcare. Our son is joining a small family-style daycare group for two afternoons a week, so my husband can do some extra work around toward his graduate school. The cost is $4 an hour. Even my CT scan was only $500 as compared with the city procedure, which would have run over $2,000. And then there's taxis and tolls, some other highs and lows. We used to spend about $120 a month on gasoline going back and forth between our two homes. Now that we drive much less, we fill the tank only about half as often, we pay less in tolls, we no longer pay for subway fare or taxis. Our son is so young that he hasn't added much to our budget yet, largely because my husband's parents have been supplying us with diapers and wipes. God bless them. But our insurance premiums did go up a hefty 64%, from $425 a month to $700 a month. Now that we have a dependent, we'll be able to claim the $1,000 child tax credit for 2006. For now, I plan to keep my quarterly tax payments the same for 2007 because until all of the chips are in from my freelance work, I won't know whether our income will be more or less than our 2006 income. And I'm somewhat embarrassed to report that our debt payments have remained the same, about $500 a month, because instead of paying off all of our debt by the new year as planned, instead we added to it. It's not your imagination. There is, in fact, a squeeze on the middle class. Now, we'd gotten our debt down to about $4,400. Now it's up to about $9,000 because we repaired and upgraded our bathroom last summer. Rather than taking out a home equity loan for a larger amount than we needed at a higher interest rate, about $7,500 at 9.5%. So we put the remodeling cost on our Visa card, about $4,500 at 5.99%. We'll pay it off more quickly this way also. Now, bold steps yield more peace of mind. So when I wrote the original article outlining my plan, I knew the underlying principle was right. Sometimes you need to take drastic steps if you want a dramatic improvement in your financial life. But still, I wasn't 100% sure that the math would work out. But it did, and worked out better than I had expected. Though there are a number of difficulties in becoming more of a country mouse, I miss my friends, and access to 46,000 cultural events happening every minute in the city. There has been a tremendous gain in terms of peace of mind. By taking this bold step, we've created a kind of financial breathing room that had eluded me in my old life. Now I have more money left at the end of the month, and instead of too much month at the end of my money, and it's a great feeling. And she puts a little section down here on what her costs were in the city and what her costs were in the country. So let me cover that for a second with you, and let me tell you a little story. I used to live in the city, the big city of Boise, Idaho. I moved out here to Isabella, Missouri, and I noticed the same thing. It costs more to live in the city than it does in the country. While it's true that out here in the country there are some things like utilities that cost more than they do in the city, overall, food, clothing, shelter cost less out here. Transportation costs less. And there's less temptations to overspend, as she pointed out. There's 46,000 cultural activities going on in the city. And you're going to be tempted and you're going to spend your money on those cultural activities, whether it's the Broadway plays or whether it's the New York Met or whether it's the Mets playing baseball or whatever it is. You know, there's events there. There's no baseball here. There's no New York Metropolitan Opera, and there's no Broadway plays. And so we don't spend any money on those things here in the country. Now, some people are going to say, well, if I have to give up those things, then I'm going to stay in the city. Well, partner, I'm not trying to get you to move to the country. I don't care. No skin off my back. But for those of you that want to get out of debt, you need to get out of the city. Because the city is a temptation that's very, very difficult to get over. The city and city life and the cultural events that transpire. When I lived in the Bay Area in San Francisco, Oakland, California, every weekend we were out spending money on some cultural event. It might be Steinhardt Aquarium. It might be Golden Gate Park. It might be, you know, the movies. It's something. You know, you've got disposable income and you're going to go spend it. Out here in the country, there's other things to do. And let me tell you that there's no shortage of things to occupy our time and occupy our things like our gardens, our gardening, our farm, our cattle, fences, work, livestock. I mean, there's all these things, you know, that occupy our time that make money, but they don't cost money. I'm not spending money, I'm making money. Now, to live the $100,000 a year lifestyle, this is from my own personal experience, so let me tell you how it worked out for me. If you want to live like the guy making $100,000 a year, now I told you I made $100,000 a year at the Atlantis Company in Boise, Idaho. To live that lifestyle in Boise, Idaho, today, I have to make $40,000. 20 years later, I got to make $40,000. Which is at about half the cost because of the cost of living. You know, the cost of living has doubled from 1980 to today, 2007. More than doubled. It doubled to 2000 and went up another 30% in the last 6 years. So I need $40,000, $2,007 to live the $100,000 lifestyle of 1980 here in the country. Now, the downside to that is that there's no employment out here in the country. You got to make your own. There are no jobs here like there is in the city. So in order to live in the country, you have to develop a modality, a system, whereby you can make your living. You know, what are you going to sell? This lady here is a writer. She can write her column in upstate New York just as easily as in her apartment in the city. I can produce these radio programs and broadcasts just as easily out here in the country as I could in downtown Chicago, St. Louis, or Kansas City. So whatever it is you do in life, if you can work at home and do your job at home, you can live in the country just as well as in the city, and the living costs will be about 60% less. In some cases, it may be as much as 80% less, such as in my case. But in this lady's case over here, they were considerably less living in the country. And now notice that from her perspective, she says, I've got more money at the end of the month than more month at the end of the money. Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Remember, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints are not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers or the sponsors or the management or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about debt. Now, we've taken a look here at the cause of debt, credit cards. We've looked at the psychology behind it. We've looked at consumerism, what are luxuries, and so on. Now we're down to the nitty-gritty. How do you get out of debt? How do you get out of debt? In my business school, I tell my students very plainly, you cannot make money while you are in debt. Now, if there's some exception, and I know somebody's going to write me a letter and say, you fool, you blind, you nitwit, why, I was in debt and I made money. That may be true. There might be somebody out there that's got debt and they're making money. I don't know how to do that. That's like being a virgin whore. Maybe there's somebody out there that can be a virgin whore, but I don't know how that's done. But I do know how to get out of debt. then I do know how to make money. I just don't know how to make money while I'm in debt. So the first thing we got to do is get you up to zero COD. Because when you're in debt, you're at minus. You're down below. I mean, you're not even at ground level. I mean, you're like the guy that just flew his F-16 into the ground at 300 miles or 600 or 800 miles an hour. I mean, we got a big hole here. You know, we got to get you out of that hole. So step number one is to get you out of debt. Now, there's a number of ways to do that. Bankruptcy is a tool. Frankly, I don't recommend bankruptcy because it's time-consuming and it wastes a lot of time, effort, and energy. I just bypass it. Just bypass it altogether. And if you've got a job, you know, you're out here working for wages. I tested that job thing that George Bush is recommending. And my observation was there's no money in employment. I never made any money as an employee. Now, I did make some dollars, and I did save some dollars, but when we get into making money, here's my definition of making money. Making money is where you buy something for a dollar, and you sell it for $2. That's making money. Working for wages is where you go in and you trade your time for dollars. That's a trade. A quid pro quo. There's no profit in that. I mean, you're giving up as much as you're getting. There's no gain. So, my observation is it doesn't make any difference if you're making $10 an hour, $20 an hour, or $50 an hour. You're going nowhere doing that. That's a nowheresville job. Now, the way to make money, from my personal experience, is this. My wife is a real master at it. I just like watching her because she's so damn smart. She's smarter than I am. I married well. I always tell people, you know, I married well. I married a woman smarter than I am, makes more money than I do, and supports me in a lifestyle that I have willingly and gladly become accustomed to. God bless her. Anyway, she goes out and she takes some money. Now, one day she went out and she took, I think it was 5,000 Federal Reserve Note dollars, because this lady didn't want gold. She wanted real money. She wanted to get paid in fiat currency of the United States. Anyway, this lady had this house she wanted to sell. And so my wife said, well, you've got a house that I'd like to buy. And so my wife bought this lady's house. But she didn't pay her $30,000, which was the price of the house. She paid her $5,000. $5,000 in fiat currency down. And she's paying her over 6 years because it fits with the Mosaic Law and the Land Sabbath Statute of Leviticus chapter 23. My wife doesn't practice communism. She practices free market private business. My wife never has been a communist. I was a communist for many years, and I blame my poverty on communism. She's never been a communist. She's always been a capitalist, and out here working and practicing the financial laws or the economic laws of the scripture, and she's always been making money. So that's why she's smarter than I am, and she's ahead of me. But anyway, she bought this house, and she's paying this lady for this house over 6 years. Well, at 10% inflation per year, compounded over 6 years, she's going to pay something less than $30,000 in real money. So she took the $30,000 in real money, that's gold, she put it in a can, because my wife, she doesn't have a bank account. And that's because my wife can count. And since she can count all by herself. See, my wife went to school. She went to school. She reads, she writes, and she can count real good, too. She doesn't need to take off her shoes and use her fingers or nothing. She can just count right off the top of her head. Real smart lady, my wife is. And I'm real smart because I married her, see? And that's why I say I married well. My granny would be real proud of me. She'd say, you know, Georgie married well. So now my wife bought this house over time under Leviticus chapter 23, under the land Sabbath rule. And she's paying for this house in fiat currency, but she has the cash money in a coffee can. And so every year she has to make a $5,000 payment to this lady. So she goes in, takes the cash, the gold, and she cashes it in. And every year the price of gold goes up and the price of Federal Reserve notes goes down. Did you get that? See, the price of Federal Reserve notes are losing value at the rate of 10% a year, and the value of gold is going up 10% a year. Now, that's 20%. So she makes 20% per year on the purchase of this house over time. And she bought the house with no interest, because the interest is against the law, too. So she bought the house with no interest, with $5,000 cash down, $5,000 a year over 6 years. Now, she sold the house for $100,000, but she sold the house for gold. Yes, sirree, Bob. Now, she didn't sell it for $100,000 in gold. She sold it for $100,000 Federal Reserve notes valued in gold at $600 an ounce. So we take $100,000 and we divide that by 600. And that gives us 166.66 ounces of gold times $50, which is $8,333. So she bought the house for $30,000 and she sold it for $8,333. Did you get that? All right, now let's write that down, boys and girls. She bought the house for $30,000 over time, and she's paying for it over years to come. Okay, and then she sold it for $8,333. Now let's see what her profit is on that. And so you take $30,000, plug that into your calculator, and then you take $8,333, and then you subtract it, and you have $21,667. So she's going to have a $21,667 loss over the next 6 years. What do you like that for a business deal? Huh? Are you following this? Now, how much capital gain tax is she going to pay on this house transaction? Can you figure that out? This is kind of advanced math. The answer is zero. There's no capital gain because she bought the house for $30 and sold it for $8,333 in gold coin. So she bought it in Federal Reserve notes and sold it in gold coin. This is a little more complex than jobs now. I mean, if you got a job now, you don't need to be able to do this higher math. All right. Now, with this $21,667 loss, there's no taxes involved, so now she's going to collect $8,333 in gold coin. Now, let's see how much money that is. Take $8,333. Dollars, and let's divide that by 50, because there's $50 in a gold coin. That's 166.66. Remember, we started with 166.66. Now, the price of gold last time I looked was about 685. I think that was yesterday. So let's take 166.66 times 685, and that amounts to $114,162. $114,162. All right. You following where we're going here? She's going to actually pay about $20,000 for the house, and she's going to sell it for $114,000. But she sold the house over time, and so the guy is paying her gold coin. Now, the gold coin is going up in value in relationship to these fiat dollars. Can you follow that? All right. I don't know how much more it's going to go up, and I'm not counting on that. I'm just pointing out that as of today, the value of the house is $114,000. So she sold it to the guy over time. Again, charging no interest. We don't charge interest here. We don't pay it, and we don't charge it. And we're just dealing in just weights and balances provided for in Title 31, Section 5102, through 5112 of the U.S. Code. Now, one of the things that's very important here, boys and girls, is that you obey all the laws all the time. I mean, you have to practice all of the tax laws of the United States. And you have to practice all of the laws of Moses. And you got to do them all the time simultaneously. That's why you need a law school education. That's why we run a law school. And then part of the law school deals with business, because there's a thing called business law. And the reason I point this out is because this is where the money's at. It's in buying, selling, and trading. It's not in jobs, jobs, jobs. And as this lady found out, living out here in the country instead of in the city offers the kinds of opportunities where you can actually practice the Ten Commandments instead of the Communist Manifesto, and you can live for less and live better out here in the country than you can in the city, and you can actually pay your debts off. Now, you got to get out of debt. Out of debt. And so in our business school, if you're interested in getting out of debt, call us and then say, look, I'm in debt and I want to get out of debt. And then mention our business school. Now, there's another school here that we teach called How to Make $100,000 a Year. That's $100,000 Fed Note dollars a year on 25 acres or less. Now, there's a lot of businesses that you can get into, but I can't think of anything better than agriculture. I really like agriculture. Now, ask any farmer and he'd say, you're a lunatic, you're nuts, you're crazy. You know, just absolute, just bonkers. The other day, I was talking to a farmer guy, and he said to me, he said, now, Mr. Gordon, I see that you have Jersey cows. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, now, the rest of us, all of us local guys around here, we have Charolais and Santa Gertrudis, and we have Whiteface, and we raise beef cows and one thing and another. And he said, now, I was over at the sale barn the other day, and I saw some real nice Jersey cows going through there, and they were going for about $1,000 a head, Springers and so on. And he said, now, my Charolais are going for about $1,400. And it looks like to us that there's more money to be made in Charolais and these other beef breeds than there is in these Jerseys. And I said, well, you're probably right. And if you were going to sell those cows, you know, all you're going to get 68 cents a pound, you know, for hamburger meat, selling Jerseys, you know, for hamburger. But I sell family milk cows. See, I'm in a little special niche over here. So let me describe this little special niche. And this is where private business comes in. The big meat packers like Tyson and ConAgra, Archer Daniels Midland, these big meat packers, these big multinational corporations have taken over the agriculture of America. They control 80% of the beef in America is controlled by five corporations. You got that? They set the prices. They tell you what you're going to get. That's the bottom line. So I woke up one day and I said, well, you know, I can either work for Tyson and ConAgra or I can work for George Gordon. And I thought, well, I'd prefer working for me rather than working for them, you know, looking for jobs, jobs, jobs. And so American cattlemen are working for Tyson. That's what it really boils down to. And I said, I didn't want to do that. So he said to me, he said, now you're selling family milk cows. He said, well, how much do you sell those for? And I said, $5,000 a cow. And I could tell he thought, why, you lying sack of manure. Why, that can't be. He said, well, who do you sell those to? I said, I sell those to people who want clean, raw milk. And he looked at me like I was suffering from the terminal stupids. Who in his right mind would want to drink raw milk? And I said, people who are health conscious want to drink raw milk. And you can't get raw milk here in this state. It's all pasteurized. Just walk into any store and tell them you want raw milk. And they'll look at you like you're stupid. And he looked at me like I was stupid, like who in his right mind? Well, I'll tell you, 12% of 300 million people want to buy raw milk. So take 300, plug it into your famous Sharp EL1197 G3, and then multiply that times 0.12, 12%, that's 36 million. There are 36 million people out here in America that want to buy raw milk. So I looked at that and I said, well, I got 36 million potential customers. who want to buy raw milk in a marketplace dominated by communism, and they can't buy it. It's a monopoly. So the Dairymen of America and Mid-America Dairies and ConAgra and the United States government and the Department of Agriculture have created an agricultural monopoly, and they have barred us all from raw milk. Except you can milk your own cow. Now, there's another problem. When your cow goes through the sale barn, the cow is dirty. The cow has to be vaccinated. You got to stick her with snake venom and monkey pus. It's the law. Unless, of course, you're breeding and raising cattle on your own farm that never go into interstate commerce, which is what I do. See, I just operate right here. And I don't operate in interstate commerce, and I'm not into the big commercial ventures of the world at Article 1, Section 10, remember. Congress regulates commerce. And so I'm just a little small private businessman down here selling my Jersey cows for $5,000 a piece to people that want to buy clean cows for raw milk on their own little family homestead. And the guy said, well, how many of these cows do you produce every year? And I said, well, I ain't going to tell you that. But I said, I sell every one that I can produce, and if I could produce 10 times more than I do produce, I could sell every one of them. Every one of them. And I said, I'm probably not charging enough, but it seems like it's enough for me. And I'm happy. Now, I don't sell these cows for $5,000 in Fed notes, because if you wanted to buy one of my cows, boys and girls, I don't deal in Federal Reserve notes. You got to pay income tax on Federal Reserve notes. You got to pay tax on income. I want to keep my income under $8,400 a year. So if you were to take that same $5,000 and just divide that, $5,000, by ounces of gold divided by about 685. Let's just try that. It turns out to be about 7.29 ounces of gold. So if you had 7.25 ounces of gold, I'd probably sell you a cow. Now, if you take 7.25 times 50, which is what a $50 gold piece is, it's $362.50. So I sell my cows for $362.50 in U.S. gold coin. That's not too bad, is it? And that keeps me under that $8,400 a year filing minimum. And then I can practice Title 31, Section 5102, 5103, 5111, and 5112. And then I can comply with Title 26. And I can comply with the law of God and the law of Moses. And I can make a good living and live out here in the country. Some guy asked me, how do you live? And I said, I live very well, thank you. Furthermore, I can eat steak and potatoes anytime I want. I think living out in the country is just real good, because I've got raw milk and I've got cows over here. I kill one every once in a while. Killed old Blondie the other day, and big steer. And I cut him up, stuck him in the freezer, made a bunch of jerky. You pay all that money, you guys, buying jerky out of the grocery store. Hell, I'll make it right here. Cost me pennies on the dollar. And then I can eat steak and potatoes anytime I want. When I want filet mignon, I just go out to the freezer and pull out a couple and stick them under the faucet and thaw them out and cook them, and there you are. Now, you got to get out of debt. You got that through your head yet? So we got to get you from minus wherever you're at, and I don't care what it is. You could be down $1 million, or $300,000, or $50,000. Doesn't make any difference. Well, first thing we do is we get you out of debt, up to zero COD. And then from zero COD, if you're of average intelligence, I say average, you need to have enough smarts between your ears, say around 100, 110 IQ. I mean, can you carry guts to a barrel? I mean, could you put urine in a pot and carry it outside and dump it behind a tree? I mean, if you're smart enough to do that, I think you could probably make a couple bucks. Now, if you got average IQ and you got a pot to do it in and a place to put it and a window to throw it out, and we can start to work, buying, selling, and trading. I think that in 36 months, 36 months. That's 3 years. Starting at zero COD. Got no money, but you got no debt. 36 months. You should have 100,000 Federal Reserve note dollars worth of gold buried in a hole in the ground somewhere, free and clear. Now, that's just following the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not steal. You shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Now, I know for a lot of you people, that's a tough pill to swallow. You've been practicing communism all your life. You went to the Harvard Business School and you've got an MBA. And you're in debt and you're leveraged out and you're making money by using other people's money. And you've got credit cards and you've got a mindset and you've got a business modality. Well, hell, if it's working and making money, keep after it. But I tested it. I tried it, and I couldn't make any money doing that. I went to the bank. I put on my underarm deodorant. I borrowed money. I leveraged her up. I went and invested the money, and I bought, sold, and traded. I paid income tax and Social Security. I had a caseworker named Mary Trudeau at the IRS. I had my bank officers. I had a letter of credit. I had 28 credit cards. In my pocket, a letter of credit in the jockey box of my truck. I was in debt up over my eyeballs. I was out here selling $1 million a year. I employed 30 people. I paid $200,000 a year in taxes. I couldn't make any money doing that. God, I just worked my heart out. I couldn't do it. So if you people with college degrees now, if you can get out there and practice communism and make money, more power to you. God bless you. Get after it. But I came down here and learned from my wife, and she was talking to a Jewish fellow. He was on the telephone. He wanted to know what her business secret was. She says, "Well, I make it on the 2% principle." Remember now, my wife. Now she'd been to school. She didn't go to college now, but she went to high school. And she got a high school diploma. She can read real good. My wife does. She reads real good, writes real good too, and she can count without even taking her shoes off. And she said, "I make it on the 2% principle." He said, "Well, how do you do that?" And she said, "Well, I buy it for a dollar, and I sell it for $2, and I make it on that 2%. And he said, he gasped. He said, why, that's 50%. And she said, "Well, now there you are getting into that higher mathematics now." And she said, "Now that's too high a mathematics for me, and I just make it on that 2%. You just remember that. You buy it for a dollar, you sell it for two, and you just live on that difference, 2%, and it'll just work out real good for you. For you. Not for you, it's for you down here. See, we don't have hollows down here, we have hollers. And it ain't for you, it's for you. All right, so there, I just wanted to share that with you. Now, this is our business school. By the way, this story here came from articles, remember? moneycentral.msn.com. Hey, we'll finish this program up in the next program here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review next time, right here. Let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the U.S. and worldwide on the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Your time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.